Hi, this is Kevin Ames, and welcome to Public Affairs here at WRCT Pittsburgh. Now, we have a lot to cover this week, a lot of things going on. Some of you have been viewing and hearing things on various newscasts, but of course, on Ebony Spectrum, man, and on In Black America, we go to some things that you haven't heard about. Stay tuned. Lots of information for you today.
This is the Black World Media Network, putting the global diaspora issues up front. Professor Ron Daniels is the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And this is From the Desk of the Professor.
The criminal in the White House charges others with fraud. How endangered is democracy in the USA? Those who bothered to participate in the 2024 election voted to elect and send a convicted felon to the White House by a slim margin in the Electoral College and the popular vote. A convicted felon who declared, "I am your retribution," and openly promised to be a dictator on day one. The USA has a serial convicted felon, a criminal in the White House who routinely cooked the books of his company to inflate or deflate the value of the assets to avoid paying taxes or gain an advantage in real estate deals. Now, this convicted felon, this criminal, Donald J. Trump, a.k.a. the Orange Man, a.k.a. Agent Orange, is seeking to fire Lisa Cook, the first black woman appointed to the Federal Reserve based on an allegation of mortgage fraud. It's a part of his plan to stack the Federal Reserve with MAGA loyalists so he can control interest rates. In an act of retribution, the Orange One has also attacked New York State Attorney General Letitia James and California Senator Adam Schiff for the same reason, alleged real estate fraud. The fact that a criminal now occupies the White House has become normalized. That's not only a shame, it's dangerous. Therefore, time and time again, we must raise our voices and remind the American public, potential voters, of this moral and political abomination. Hashtag, criminal in the White House.
That viewpoint was ripped from the desk of the professor, Ron Daniels. Listen daily for a view on a myriad of issues from the desk of the professor. This is the Black World Media Network.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
When do we want it?
Now!
When do we want it?
Now!
When do we want it?
Yeah.
We won't go back.
We won't go back.
We won't go back. All right. They said 62 years ago that the dream that Martin Luther King Jr. spoke about was a dream that died in the late 60s. But there were those that kept on fighting. And we went from a balcony in Memphis that killed the dreamer to having a black family on the Truman balcony at the White House. We never stopped dreaming. But now that we have an anti-dreamer, one that wants to cut the tax rate for the rich, and have cuts in Medicaid and SNAP paid for it. Why do we come to Wall Street? Since you have benefited from Trump, we come to tell you your benefit days are numbered. We're not going back. You said, well, we have a couple of hundred people. We were blocked along, thousands marched.
We march towards your offices because we know your address. And we're going to march and keep coming to you until we turn the economic inequality in this country around. We're not going back. Let me tell you something. The fact of the matter is the first thing traded on Wall Street was black bodies. The largest two ports for slave trade in America was Charleston, South Carolina, and Wall Street, New York. They stood us up right in this area and sold us like a bar of soap, sold us like we were some inhuman particle. But we come back the children of our ancestors. We come back ready to vote, ready to spend our dollars. We're not slaves anymore. We're not going back on the slave market. Donald Trump, get ready for the fight of your life. Somebody said, you can't fight Trump. He got too much power. He has the majority of the Supreme Court. He has the majority of the U.S. Senate. He has the majority of the House of Representatives. Yeah, but there's something he doesn't have. He don't realize that our grandparents and our parents fought when they didn't have a right to vote. They fought when there were segregation laws. They fought when, as slaves, it was against the law to read and write. We are the most educated and refined African Americans in the history of this country. If we could fight when we had nothing, we can fight with what we got now. Some say, well, Reverend Al, use this strategy, use that. It reminds me of Saul in the Bible. After they thought David wasn't fit to fight. David was just a shepherd boy. David had never been to boot camp. David had never been military trained. When they finally said, all right, he keeps insisting to fight, let him fight. Saul said, well, use my sword and use my shield and use my helmet. David said, no, I don't need your stuff. I got a slingshot and a few smooth stones. Trump, don't let the folk around you tell you what we gonna fight you with. We come to Wall Street with our slingshots. You don't know how we gonna fight. We gonna meet you at every turn. We gonna meet you at every ballot box. We gonna meet you at every time you take the Dow Jones. We gonna factor in. We gonna take our dollars where we respect it, and we gonna close down where we reject it. If you don't want diversity, inclusion, in an economic inclusion in our policy, then you don't need diversity in our consumer dollar. You don't. We will shop with who does business with us, who walks with us. We will stand with who stands with us. And we are not afraid of Trump. We've been beating giants since David. You just one more giant we got to face. Right now, they are trying to redo district lines. They can't win fair, so they're going through redistricting fights. Then they go through now trying to change how they choose governors in the Federal Reserve. We are seeing things we never saw before. But let me tell you something. They never seen us before. You're dealing with a new person. And we not by ourselves. Because if you looked all the blocks we filled, some of our white brothers and sisters was here. LGBTQ some Gentile. We all coming together because we are not going to let you in this democracy and go into an autocracy. Let me say this as I wind down. I know some of you rode all night to get here. You're here from Tennessee. Tennessee in the house. Tallahassee, Florida in the house. Atlanta, Georgia in the house. Baltimore, Maryland in the house. Buffalo, New York in the house. New Jersey in the house. Washington, D.C. in the house. We've gone all Detroit, Michigan in the house. We are all over the country, but all of us on Wall Street, because we wanted y'all to know the address, because we coming back with an escalated movement. We will not get off Wall Street. You are the ones financing Trump. You better back him up or we are going forward. And I saw Mayor Baraka, Ras Baraka spoke from Newark. I invited all the candidates for mayor to be here. So I don't endorse candidates, but I take attendance. Let's hear from Andrew Cuomo. Oh, he's not here. Let's hear from Eric Adams. Oh, he's not here. Let's hear from Zoran Mandani.
How are we doing today? Is the dream still alive? Is the dream still alive? Is the dream still alive? We know that dream lives on in every single person who is here today. It is a dream that we have heard time and again that it has to be deferred. And yet we know that its time has come. As we stand here in the wealthiest city, in the wealthiest country in the history of the world, as we stand here by Wall Street, where last year they had more than $40 billion in bonuses. We ask ourselves, how is it that one in four New Yorkers are still living in poverty? We ask ourselves, how is it that we have still yet to answer the question that Dr. King posed all those decades ago? Because what he said then, and what we must answer now, is what good is it to have the right to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a hamburger? Our freedom is only as good as our ability to exercise it. And I want to thank Reverend Sharpton. I want to thank the King family for continuing to show that this dream lives on. And it will live on until we achieve that dream where every single person in this city and in this country has the dignity that they deserve in their lives. So my name is Zohran Kwame Mamdani. I stand before you as a man looking to be the next mayor of this city. And I tell you that every day I will wake up with Dr. King's dream at the forefront of my mind, a dream where we make this city, the most expensive in the United States of America, affordable for each and every person across this city. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you for marching. Thank you to the Rev. Thank you to the family. And to Donald Trump, we say this to you. We will continue to fight for that which our forefathers have fought for. Because what we fight for is no less than what we deserve. And we will not let you take that dignity from us. We will not let you take that decency from us. We will not let you take it from us because we will be here fighting each and every day for that which we deserve. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Now listen, I want us, as we get ready to depart, Don't let anybody agitate you. Don't let nobody provoke you. You made a great statement today. We had not any incidents. One guy come with a cowbell. He thought slavery was still in. We don't do cows no more. He about 400 years late with his cowbell. Don't even entertain it. Go home, let's organize. We're going to give you marching orders all the way through, because Trump must be defeated with disciplined strategy and with disciplined activism. That's why people rode all night to get here, to show that we have the discipline and we have the tenacity to fight this fight. They built a movement from the Tea Party to the Birther movement to Trump and the MAGA movement. We're building a movement to counter that. They're not smarter than us. They're not stronger than us. They're not more durable than us. And they're not more determined than us. One young man, Reverend McHenry, has led marches here for 86 weeks. 86 weeks, he and a group have marched from National Action Network in front of Bill Ackman's office, who started the fight against DEI. He's a true soldier, and that's what we want. We don't want no punks in this army. We don't want nobody that just wants to shine on the 6 o'clock news but don't show up at the rallies. This is gonna be a long fight, and that's why we need young folk like Ron McHenry and Malcolm Byrd. I'm tough on them because they were tough on me. But if you can't take the training, you can't get in the ring.
Hey, family, thank you for tuning in to the Jamal Brown Podcast. Let's be clear. It is said that iron sharpens iron, and a lot of us have become dull because we're rubbing up against plastic. One of the sharpest minds of our time is with us on today, Dr. Michael Eric Dotson. And he is spinning the bottle talking about everything in terms of present-day hip-hop culture, the illiteracy of the black church, the critical thinking that is necessary in the country, and the dumbing down that is being celebrated as a top form of genius. Everything that is offensive starts with our mind. Howard Thurman said, with head and heart. A lot of us are taking our hearts and leaving our heads on the table. I want you to share this podcast with every person who always has a question, every person who thinks about things differently, who dances to the beat of a different drum, who's got an outlandish idea, has got a crazy concept, who is a creative but can't draw, can't paint, and can't sing. I want them to be a part of it, and I need you to share with them. This conversation, if it will not change your mind, it will at least enlarge it.
The richest white boys dropped out. Did Mark Zuckerberg finish? Did Steve Jobs finish? Did Bill Gates finish? They all dropped out. And they dropped out of the school. She dropping out of Harvard.
Right.
That's different than dropping out of Podunk. But the point is, they pursued their dreams and ambitions. Not like us. It's DEI. Saying you Negroes are not like us, superior white folk, not like us, is arguing that Republicans have got a copyright on what is exactly moral about this community. Not like us is one of the most perfectly fascist statements that has been articulated, and it happens to be in a black voice. Fascism ain't just an interesting moment on MSNBC.
That's right.
Fascism has come to your neighborhood. They are banning books. They are banning, therefore, black bodies and banning black brains and banning black intelligence. Voting is still a critical means to exercise democratic, small d, energy, and democracy is at stake. And the vote is critical. People die for it.
Wikipedia, ChatGPT, none of them got as much knowledge as the black Albert Einstein. Michael Eric Dotson is in the building. Thank you, sir.
Reverend Dr. Jamal Bryan. Mama, I made it. I'm on Jamal Bryan's podcast. Now, if I get to the pulpit, I might go on to heaven.
Oh, listen.
Lord Jesus.
Going to heaven. You got to get that. I needed you to come in and just do a crash course on America's anti-intellectualism.
Because
of where it is that we are right now, nobody is thinking.
Man, I'm so glad you started there. Look, there's a famous book, Richard Hofstadter, 1963, Anti-Intellectualism in America. Now, he wasn't talking about Negroes. One of the advantages of racism and Jim Crow, all the villains were white.
Wow.
All the crazy folk were white, right?
Yeah.
Crazy in parentheses here because we don't want to dismiss mental health. But the point is that when he's talking about 1963 anti-intellectualism, he ain't responding to what's going on in the culture now. He's talking about the fact that they chose Dwight D. Eisenhower over a greater candidate on the Democratic side who could have presented a far more compelling argument in defense of democracy. So, you know, if back then they talk about Dwight Eisenhower as an avatar of what's incompetence.
Yes.
What we talk about right now in this culture. So the allergy to intellectual engagement, the allergy to sophistication, not in terms of abstract discourse that nobody can understand. Because Jesse Jackson said something to me once. He said, if you say something I can't understand, that's a failure of your education, not mine.
Wow.
I have never forgotten that.
Though. Wow.
I have never forgotten that. And look, there are arenas in which you got to do all that, the insurrection of subject, knowledge is involved. But you ought to do all that. Right. But the thing is, if you can't master it so you can't explain it, then nobody else can understand what you're saying. You don't understand it yourself.
That's correct.
So anti-intellectualism is sometimes fed by an unnecessary addiction to obscure discourse as opposed to having the courage to be clear and to be lucid.
As somebody who has given their life to the academy, tell me what your thoughts are when you are alone thinking about the dismantling of the Department of Education.
Oh, my Lord. It is astonishing. It is astonishing that an onslaught, a siege of the most merciless unintelligence that this nation has seen at the highest office in the land. This man is proud to be unmolested by enlightenment.
Ooh.
And the woman who is the symbolic head of the Department of Education, her sole purpose is to WWE dismantle it, to have it as a wrestling match between forces pitched against fascism on the one hand, autocratic dispensation on the other, and the authoritarian refusal to acknowledge the legitimacy of critical intelligence. Why? Because the biggest threat to an autocrat is knowledge. The biggest threat to an authoritarian is somebody who knows you ain't doing the right thing. And for the Department of Education, and people think, well, you know, it's just a kind of bureaucratic formality. No, it ain't. This is where a large part of arguments and cases about justice and injustice, about racial injustice, happen at that level. So when you dismiss the Department of Education, you ain't just getting rid of a formal bureaucratic procedure. You're getting rid of an avenue that allows us to adjudicate claims about what is just and unjust in America.
I really wrestle with where it is that we are as a country, and as a country seemingly of a she and not of goats. I am concerned, Dr. Dyson, about the absence or the disconnect of intellectual social engagement of the black pulpit,
right.
Where the white pulpit are willfully ignorant.
We not even audited in the class.
Are you considering a career in the legal field but worried about the lengthy and expensive process? Let us introduce you to an alternative path that's efficient, affordable, and just as rewarding.
I want you to really challenge the thought process of the black pulpit and the black church to really think through their theology, their hermeneutic, and what it is that we're leading our people to, because It's almost Silence of the Lambs.
It is Silence of the Lambs. And I don't know who's playing Anthony Hopkins, but somebody is out here eating people alive.
Yeah.
So here's the thing, and I'm glad you said it that way. You know, I go to some of these places because, like you, I'm a black person in these spots,
right,
in spaces where actual, real, existing black people live. And a lot of them go, is that all we're going to do is sit around here and talk? Mm. Is that what... Well, the white boys and the white folk,
yeah,
got their intellectuals, but they don't ask them, are they going to sit around and talk? They say, can you frame a document called Project 2025 and legitimately validate what we believe into intellectually credible, digestible moments or sophisticated, erudite expositions about race, about DEI, about class, about culture, about religion? So they use their white intellectuals to further their goals, and we crapping on. Now, I'm not saying that that happens every time, right, in every case, but it happens enough where I feel the heat of that resistance. Now, some of us have been eggheads who are horrible as black intellectuals. No doubt about it, we know that there are bad apples. But for the most part, most scholars have been reared in black communities that have taught them the necessity of bridging the gap between what they do in the classroom and what happens in the larger culture. Now, not everybody is a public intellectual. They're not going to go on TV. They're not going to explain these things in public, but they're writing the books that inform those who do. Tupac said, I might not change the world, but I bet I'll spark the brain that will.
Mm.
And so sparking the brain that changes is extremely important. So when we see folk like a Freddie Haynes, a Jamal Bryant, and I'm saying this, I ain't saying this because I've said it behind your back. Somebody just asked me for my list of the greatest preachers in the country, and you and Freddie Haynes at the top of that list. That kind of rhetorical Jew.
Let's stop right there. Let's burn incense. I'm on it. I made it.
But look at here. That kind of rhetorical genius that you all possess, that ability, you talk about hermeneutic, the ability to interpret the signs of the time, so to speak, and to be able to clearly articulate the base and the focus and the energy that we need to have, that's a gift.
Yeah.
And so, but it's necessary that those who possess like gifts, similar gifts, are not moved to make those similar moves. You're in the pulpit, you have ecclesiastical orgasm, but you have no sanctification beyond those walls of those who don't have access to you. You ain't making it plain for those. What the old people used to say, put it where the goats can get it.
Right.
And so they can do that rhetorically. They can talk about theology that way. They can speak about some homiletical exegetical moment, but they can't break it down that if you say Jesus is the light of the world and homeboy can't keep his lights on, what's the disconnect? And so for me, I challenge those of us who are scholars to go into the world to help the world understand the black world, right? The larger world for sure. But in our own worlds, we need to help people understand why it is that these issues are important and why they need to be taking them up. Fascism ain't just an interesting moment on MSNBC.
That's right.
Fascism has come to your neighborhood. They are banning books. They are banning, therefore, black bodies and banning black brains and banning black intelligence. And what we have to do is to resuscitate them, to recuperate them. Our churches should be warehouses for the intelligentsia of the community where we are teaching the very books that they are banning in these schools. If we could do that, we could change our worlds in a very powerful and tangible fashion.
Nah, I love it. I wanted to ask you if you could speak to, for one moment, almost as an elder brother, as a statesman in the community, what would your conversation, if it's not me sitting in this chair, if it's Shannon Sharp sitting in this chair, you would say what to you?
Well, Shay Shay got a heck of an audience, number one. Shay Shay got a Club Shay Shay. And I have been on Club Shay Shay. Now, I was on Club Shay Shay before they were doing it like he doing it now.
Yeah, you were free cat.
Cat, wait.
You got free cat.
Nah, nah.
Yeah.
Let me tell you one thing.
Okay.
I was free cat because cat that changed the game.
I love it. For
So, but I think a Shannon Sharp, to his credit, allows people to come on his show. Some people criticize him for this, but the beautiful thing, he lets you stretch out. He gonna let you say what you gotta say. None of these sound bites where, oh, I was misinterpreted. No, you spoke for about 10 minutes on that one subject.
These were too weirdly shaped or odd to make the cut in a regular pack of bacon, but bacon is bacon, maybe.
I don't know what else it was, though.
Yeah.
But that's on you,
right?
And that's a genius doc in its own right. Similar to you, you know how to guide a conversation. You know how to get people to bring out their best. And the best hosts are capable of doing that. You want to have just enough to tease what somebody believes, but you want to give them space either to surrender to a larger moment and purpose that illuminates the context for everybody. And you want to be able to have the possibility of being clear in a context where you have the space to break it down. And I think Shannon Sharp did that has done that in a brilliant way. And we know his recent troubles and trials. Thank God that stuff was at least legally situated. I think he'll get back on the path. But what he and Ocho Cinco are doing, that revolutionized that platform. Now, the question is, what do we do? What advantage do we take of that moment? It's not about simply pop culture, though that's critically important. You are a figure in pop culture. You address pop culture. That's extremely important because that's where people live. And we live by analogy and metaphor. It's like this, the Real Housewives of, or it's like this, what we're doing on TikTok. So we have to take those things seriously. But at the same time, we got to say, but at the end of the day, what did we do with algorithms? What did we do with social media? What did we do with Club Shay Shay? What did we do with a podcast? We began to formulate ideas and principles that allow ordinary citizens to have a sense of how much power they possess, the things they have to do, and what the agenda is for their daily life.
Joining us now is Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California. She is the ranking member on the House Financial Services Committee, and Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida. She is the former chair of the DNC.
Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, it's good to see you again. It's been a while. Lots happened over the summer, and here we are as we head into the fall with the president making a power grab against the Federal Reserve. They've telegraphed and promoted this effort through Project 2025 and other means for quite some time. But we're now finding ourselves in this space. As you come back to Washington after the holiday this weekend, and you assess where we are, what is your assessment on this power grab against the Fed? What are Democrats thinking about in terms of responding once you're officially back here in town? And then bottom line, what does it mean for the American wallet, for folks out there, if Donald Trump gets away with booting off responsible leadership and putting on, you know, troglodytes when it comes to the economy?
Well, Michael and Simone, thanks so much for having me. I'll be honest, I didn't have Trump overthrowing the central bank on my bingo card this summer. And the fact that we're even having this conversation, like Simone said, is breathtaking. I mean, if he wants to tank the dollar and figure out a way to do it as fast as possible, then, you know, jeopardizing and eliminating the independence of the central bank, which is the backbone of our nation's economy, is the way to do it. Trump is doing this pure and simple because he has not been able to strong arm the Federal Reserve into lowering interest rates. And we already have a fragile economy. We already see the tariffs that he's been imposing dramatically increasing prices. Today, you know, we heard that the huge tariffs that previously smaller, lower priced items coming from overseas were going to be exempt from, now they will be imposed. So the impact on our buying power and the impact on our economy when it comes to our purchasing power is going to be dramatically impacted, to say nothing of the fact that he is completely upending the independence of our healthcare system and our scientific research. He is threatening our nation's safety when it comes to meddling with FEMA, threatening to close it down and hiring completely unqualified individuals to run it. And then add insult to injury. He is firing the head of our CDC. If he wants to make sure that we have if Kennedy wants to make sure we have qualified individuals running our healthcare system, he should resign.
Congresswoman Waters, you know, I think Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz lays out a very concerning picture, if you will. You add what we're talking about this morning during the court hearing, if you will, on the suit that Governor Lisa Cook has brought against the president, the board of the Federal Reserve, and to be very clear, Jerome Powell. And it's just striking to me. You know, this is what the New York Times had to, pardon me, I don't know if it's the Times, but this is what we have about this new playbook from the president. It's about mortgage fraud targets, and he's targeting political foes with unproven mortgage fraud accusations. Today is Lisa Cook, Federal Reserve Governor. He's had lobbed the same things to Tish James, New York Attorney General, Senator Adam Schiff. Lisa Cook hasn't been charged with any crime, and today in court, her legal team highlighted that there was not any investigation or charge being leveled at her attempted firing. So help me understand, Congresswoman, what is really going on?
Well, I think, you know, not only do I believe I know what's going on, I think a lot of folks watching this, a lot of elected officials and analysts and experts and academicians all watching the president exercise unusual power. Mm-hmm. This is flagrant. This is something that the president has decided to do, be damned the Constitution of the United States, where an independent agency is under attack. He wants to control the Fed. He wants to be able to determine interest rates. He wants to be able to have the people on the governing board that will do exactly as they are told. This is extraordinarily dangerous. This is the makings of a dictator who is trying to control the entire economy, determining what interest rates are and what they are not. And if they don't get frightened out of office and just leave, he's going to fire them. Well, the Constitution does not allow that. And so the question becomes, the Constitution says for cause. What is cause? Undefined. Mm. And so he does not get a chance to exercise any executive order to fire. And I want you to know Lisa Cook is doing the right thing. She is taking him to court on a temporary restraining order. It was heard today. Let's see where it goes from here, because as you said, there's no proof. There's no investigation. There's nothing but the president saying, I want you out. It doesn't work.
You know, I want to pick up on that last part from Congresswoman Waters, Debbie, because it speaks so much to where we are right now, and it speaks so much to what we know in front of our eyes. We see this happening, and in one sense, it's really fast because it's one thing after the other, but in another, it's really kind of like slow motion, right? You just sit there and goes like, oh, my God.
Like watching a car crash.
It's like watching a car crash. And in so many ways, we've come to this moment where Lisa Cook has become the sort of the figure, the image of the Project 2025 effort, where she, as an independent agent, as an independent actor within our financial system, a part of our financial infrastructure, whom, you know, went through a process and was vetted. And yes, you know, it was a tough battle, but she got confirmed and was ready to serve out her 14-year term. But this president has other plans. And part of that is the power grab. The other part is the self-enrichment, the reporting that this man could walk out of the office with an extra $3.4 billion. If he walks out of the office. And that's another conversation we're going to talk about at some point. But Lisa Cook is this symbol now. How do you see her as a point of discussion for the country? Because in one sense, she's representative of the independence this country was built on, right? Institutions, sort of checks and balances, the freedom to govern ourselves. He wants to wipe all this away. He wants to control every aspect of it. How do you make that case?
Well, let me just say that I think that the way that you're approaching this and you're describing this is absolutely what should be done. This is a moment. that everyone should pay attention to. This is a brazen disregard for the Constitution of the United States of America. What are we going to do? Normally, in what he has been doing, we have been filing amicus briefs in court to try and deal with some of his executive orders. But this goes beyond this, because this stands to basically upend the entire economy. This stands to really deal with what is going to happen on Wall Street, what's going to happen with interest rates, what's going to happen with the President of the United States being able to make decisions that he will personally benefit from. And so the world, and certainly the United States, should be watching this very closely. And as far as I'm concerned, we have to move very aggressively. It is not about, you know, lingering and trying to think that maybe the courts will help us. I want, even though I know it may not happen, the cabinet that he's appointed, a bunch of his sycophants who probably won't do what I would recommend. It is time to call for Article 25 of the Constitution of the United States of America to determine his unfitness, to determine that something's wrong with this president. And I would suggest that we move very aggressively to talk about the danger to this country and to our democracy, and not play around with this, because this is absolutely one of the most destructive things that this president could do.
Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, I mean, your take on this, because I think it's jarring to hear Congresswoman Waters say it's time for the 25th Amendment, but I mean, presidents have been impeached for much less.
This is true.
This one included, Simone.
Come on now.
twice. Not once, but twice. You know, he knows Donald Trump's real preference is to fire Jerome Powell. But, you know, he knows that that's a bridge too far. So what he's doing instead is he's taking a monkey wrench and he's going to go in and try to, you know, meddle with the component parts of the Federal Reserve by trying to fire Lisa Cook on something that she like was maintained in the court case today, that she's not even being investigated for. By the way, the so-called fraud that she is being accused of, she didn't even get preferred interest rates on any of the mortgages that she obtained, which demonstrates that she didn't break the law. It's preposterous. What he's trying to do is make sure that he can bend the central bank to his will so that he can make sure that he controls our economy politically. And it is going to be devastating. What needs to happen is we need the CEOs of major corporations, corporate America, whose bottom line will be gutted if this happens, need to speak up. It is time to pull the cord, to sound the alarm bell. And I mean, Congresswoman Waters and I and our colleagues on the Democratic side have been fighting Trump in Congress, in the courts, and in the community. And we need corporate America to step up and be responsible here and make sure that the American people, help us make sure the American people understand what's at stake if he's allowed to actually succeed in taking over and controlling what happens at the central bank.
If now is not the time for action, when is the time? What's it going to take? Joining us now is Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. She represents the district that Annunciation is located in.
Welcome, Congresswoman. Condolences to the community and the families. Your leadership right now is important in this moment, not just because of what you can say or do legislatively, but having that presence there to show that as an elected official, you are on the ground with your folks and you appreciate this journey. I agree with the mayor. The thoughts and prayers, I'm so beyond that nonsense, the lie of that. Because what we have are people who continue to stand in the way of actually doing something to stop the violence against their own kids. It is amazing to me. We watch young kids die in classrooms and now in church. And all we get are thoughts and prayers. What can you tell us about this community? And what's on your heart at this moment as you sort of wrap your head around yet again another national tragedy involving the killing of young kids?
Thank you all for having us. And I would say our community does in many ways appreciate the prayers and the support that we are getting, the outpouring of support. What I feel is the most tragic as a mother, as a member of this community, is that the fact that these, you know, two angels were doing one of the most innocent things we want our kids to do, which is to sit in prayer. And they were assassinated by an assailant who did get access to a deadly weapon that did now shatter the lives of two, will forever impact the lives of 17 others, and will forever have a lasting impact, not just on our entire community, but the Catholic community within Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. This is the first time they have felt targeted, and it is important for us to remember that these tragedies can be avoided. You know, we talked about thoughts and prayers and taking action when Columbine happened back when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. We talked about the devastation of Sandy Hook when I was a young mom. And we are still talking about it. And I cannot imagine the heartbreak that these families must feel knowing that they had just dropped off their babies to go to school and to start their day praying. And to be called within moments after they had dropped their children off and be told that not only some of their children were dead, others were hospitalized, and their whole community and their lives will forever be changed. We have to take action.
Congresswoman, what does that action look like? The last time that there was a gun prevention bill was in 2022. President Biden signed that into law. It was bipartisan in nature. But this administration, just last month, it was reported in Reuters that the Trump administration slashed federal funding for gun violence prevention. I'm going to read something to you. The Trump administration has terminated more than half of all federal funding for gun violence prevention programs in the U.S., cutting $158 million in grants. A DOJ official told Reuters the gun violence grants were eliminated because they, quote, no longer effectuate the program's goals or agency's priorities. It feels like the federal government is not coming to save the children of America from things like this. It feels like on the state level, on the local level, something is going to have to change. People are going to have to be more creative to figure out how to stop these kinds of things. Do you agree with that?
I do, but we also have to understand that we live in a union. You know, in Minnesota, we have strong gun laws, but Indiana is not that far away from us. And so we have to recognize, as, you know, people who live in the United States, you know, a community like Minneapolis or the state of Minnesota taking action does not prevent our neighbor from coming and harming one of our community members. And so we have to collectively think of ourselves as people who collectively reside in this country, who are impacted by the decisions that are the lack of decisions or decisions that are made in different states, because we are in one country, and so there has to be federal laws that are introduced that safeguard life in this country. That, you know, Simone said something earlier that sits with me forever, which is, you know, we have this problem uniquely as a country, because the rest of the world, once they saw there might be a problem, once they got their first taste of that heartbreak of losing their children in a senseless way, they said, no more, not again. And so in our country, in order to continuously make excuses on why we are not going to take a collective action on a federal level that collectively addresses this problem, is beyond me. And I want the mothers, you know, in this country to rise up and to recognize that for the love of the Second Amendment, for the love of our gun culture, we have to have a greater love for our kids. We have to have a greater love for the safety of our community. Something has to prevail because the rest of the world has decided that they love their children way more than they love their ability to have easy access to guns. And we have to get there as well.
You know, I was struck by a lot of the reactions from people, not just in Minneapolis and in Minnesota today, but folks on cable news, folks all across the country. And I want to play for you something that Trey Gowdy actually had to say.
Our system is reactive. Something bad happens, we react to it. And what people are crying for now is, how can we prevent this? How can we stop it? And the only way to stop it is to identify the shooter ahead of time or keep the weapons out of their hands. And so we're going to have a conversation of freedom versus protecting children. I mean, how many school shootings does it take?
It's a great question. I mean, but Trey Gowdy, and this isn't the first time he's spoken out about gun violence, particularly in school shootings, but he used to represent South Carolina's 4th Congressional District from 2011 to 2019. I don't recall him introducing legislation, federal legislation. I think that he is asking the right question. Apparently today was enough for Trey Gowdy. Is it enough for the rest of your Republican colleagues? How many more children have to die in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I do believe Trey is correct in saying we have to ask these questions. And I don't actually think the choice has to be between freedom and love of our children and the protection of our children. I think there are ways in order for us to continue to have freedoms, but to wisely decide there has to be some safeguards. We have freedoms in all other aspects, and we always create safeguards to make sure people are protected. And so I do believe that we have to put our past statements, our past views, you know, in the rear view mirror, come together as a country, as lawmakers who make a decision on a federal level and collectively make a decision on something that makes sense, that keeps our children, our communities safe. I think we have done enough blaming each other, never really coming to the solution. But I think it is time for us to find a solution to make sure guns don't end up in the wrong hands. But also, yes, to what he was saying, there is somebody who knows something. So obviously, we need to also collectively think of our collective safety and decide, yes, it is time to call somebody. It is time to say something when you notice that there is some sort of red flag that is being presented. You know, we see all of these YouTube videos that are later shown to people, or their social media presence, and people just kind of disregard it. If someone is posting something that is alarming to you, please, please, for the sake of our children, tell someone so that they can be alerted and there can be action taken before a life is lost.
Congresswoman, I could not agree more with not just the sentiment of what you just expressed, but the importance of it relative to public policy, because there's always been this space in which the character, the nature of the individual, the things that lead that individual to behave and act out the way they do, that's not been accounted for in the past. And yet there are people around that person who see this behavior, who should be alerted to it and have the confidence and the ability to alert others. And that's very, very important. You can't necessarily legislate that. And I think that's part of what you're saying. So there is sort of the humanity of all of us that has to come forward in a moment like this, for sure. But even before now, here's where I have the problem when it comes to this issue, as someone who's a gun owner and certainly been a supporter of the Second Amendment in the traditional political context, is that when your house is on fire, do you let it burn or do you call for help? And that's really what we're talking about here. We're watching our children burn in the fire, in the gunfire, in the hails of bullets that are shot at them. We're watching it in nightclubs. We're watching it in our schools. and yet we somehow don't want to call for help. Right now, how would you ask Congress to call for help and to be that help?
Yeah, I mean, I would say let's come together and figure out a solution. There are, you know, compromises that can be made to both honor the freedoms that people want to have and to honor the lives that have been lost with real solutions to stop the loss of life going forward. I don't think protecting our children should be a partisan issue, you know, and I don't think it is a partisan issue for us to say it is alarming for places where we send our children to get an education should not be a place where we worry if they get slaughtered. Places of worship where we want our little angels praying to God is a place where we want to see them get slaughtered. This to me sounds common sense.
President Trump and Mayor Muriel Bowser are getting on the same page, and they agree that the surge of law enforcement is cutting down on crime in the city. 7 News reporter John Gonzalez has the latest on what D.C. leaders are saying.
Yeah, you know, the mayor says there's no denying that crime has dropped since this federal surge started 3 weeks ago. Overall crime down 8%. Carjackings down over 80%, and police saying that a ton of guns have been seized and taken off the streets. But the mayor also says there is a downfall to this crackdown. Take a look. She took questions from reporters for about 45 minutes yesterday with Police Chief Pamela Smith. The mayor highlighted the drop in crime, but she told reporters that masked ICE and Homeland Security agents in neighborhoods have broken trust with residents, and National Guard troops from out of state haven't been effective, she believes. The mayor also saying she wants more MPD officers, prosecutors, and judges, not just outside agencies.
To make sure that while we have federal resources, that we are strategically using them to enhance MPD's efforts and to make sure that we are getting the best outcomes for D.C. residents. While at the same time making sure that we're living up to our commitments to D.C. residents and protecting local control and our autonomy.
That press conference coming just days after the president signed the two executive orders to expand federal control. The mayor says she raised her concerns directly in a meeting with the president yesterday, promising to push for more accountability in the weeks ahead. At Union Station, John Gonzalez, 7 News.
John, thank you. And the president has just about 2 weeks until his 30-day emergency rule on D.C. expires. If he wants to extend it, he'll have to get permission from Congress. And a lot of people are wondering if D.C. can keep up the progress that it's seen once that federal surge is over. The chairman of the D.C. Police Union agrees that the answer is more officers on the streets, but says there's a clear roadblock.
The reason that we're here is because of bad law that was passed by the city council.
And that bad law that you heard him reference there, it's the Police Reform Act of 2020. It was created in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The chairman says officers are hesitant to join and work in the district because that legislation exposes them to more administrative, civil, and criminal penalties. He says D.C. is on pace to lose another 120 officers this year, and getting staffing levels where they need to be at around 4,000 officers, it depends on reversing the policy. And since the takeover started, more than 80 people experiencing homelessness have gone to shelters. MPD Chief Pamela Smith says tonight they'll take a new census of the homeless population, and that will be the first since late January, which showed a 9% decrease over the past year. And we are hearing from D.C.'s top cop on a story that we've been digging into for weeks now. The House committee is now investigating allegations that D.C. police has manipulated crime statistics in the past to make them appear lower. And here's what MPD Chief Pamela Smith had to say when she was asked about this yesterday.
The chairman of the Government Oversight Committee, Comer, sent a letter to you recently asking for all kinds of things, all kinds of records, and for transcribed interviews with seven MPD commanders. Are you cooperating with that? How is that going?
We will cooperate. We have been cooperating, and we will continue to cooperate.
And the committee is asking for a wide variety of records and interviews with the police commanders in all seven of D.C.'s patrol districts.
Very, very interesting. Take care, everyone. Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to the Jazz Corner.